I'm actually going to catch up a little bit from where I was one time before. I don't know. I think everybody here was at Pentecost in Troy, Illinois, I believe. Is that correct? I think everybody here was. We had combined services on Pentecost, and I spoke there on the Ten Commandments. I gave a sermon on that subject because a lot of people have the idea that the Ten Commandments are basically this minimal standard of righteousness, that they really don't teach us anything about loving your neighbor, which is kind of funny because we know that they expand on that, but directly, that they don't tell us we have to help the needy, they don't forbid vanity, selfishness, lust, and greed, that the Ten Commandments don't explicitly do that. And in that sermon that we went through, I showed that the Ten Commandments are a spiritual law. As Paul said, the law is spiritual. And as David said, the commandments are exceedingly broad, and they cover a broad spectrum of subjects within these broad categories. And so we went through and basically showed all through the Bible that that was the case in a sort of an overview sense. But one thing that I did not get to do in that message that I really wanted to was to go through each of the commandments specifically, to go through them individually and look at them and show how they apply in a much broader sense. Now, in one sense, this is review. The Ten Commandments is very basic. But the Ten Commandments are quite expressive beyond, again, the mere letter of them. They have a lot more to tell us. We need to understand the intent behind these commandments and why they were given. And understand that really what the Ten Commandments are broad categories. That's what the Ten Commandments are. They are broad categories. We should not think of them as these specific statements alone. We should not think of them as just merely these, just the specific wording that we find in Exodus 20. And I would like you to turn over to Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, because we just find the commandments listed in both of these passages in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. But I'd like you to turn over to Exodus 20, and we're going to go through these commandments one at a time and just see the broader application and how these commandments do tell us a lot more than what is specifically stated in the listing of them here. Now, if we look in Exodus 20, I think I mentioned to you before that there's a different, people order these differently. There's a Jewish ordering, there's a Protestant ordering, there's a Catholic ordering of exactly what the Ten Commandments are. And according to the Jewish ordering, they reckon verse number 2, where he says in Exodus 20, and God spoke all these words. And by the way, when God spoke the words, we know that the one who actually spoke there at the time was Jesus Christ, the one who became Jesus Christ. He spoke the commandments, and they were heard by the people. But in verse 2, he says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That statement is really a preamble. The Jewish reckoning considers that a first commandment, but there's really no command there. There's just a general purpose statement. Think of it again, like as a preamble. You think of the preamble of the United States Constitution. It gives you the whole point of what we're talking about here. And what we see here is that God pointed to his providential security and deliverance of his people as also fundamental to a right relationship with him. In this preamble statement, God told the Israelites, whom he'd recently freed from slavery, what did he say? I am the Lord your God. He identified himself, and he told them what he did. He said, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So God declared both who he was and what he had done for them. And this statement applies not just to the Israelites, but it applies to all of us in a very important sense, a figurative sense. But let's think about it. God is our Savior. We owe him our worship and obedience, not only because he made us, but also because he saves us and maintains our lives and liberty. So we have this what the obligation is. That's what God's showing by that verse. By nature of who he is and what he has done for us, we owe him these obligations that we find delineated here in the next statements, these Ten Commandments. So let's look at the first commandment. We'll start with number 1. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, we might think of that in just a simple literal sense and say, well, so what that means is we're not supposed to worship Ashtaroth or Apollo or some other pagan deity. But yet, think about that in a more specific term. There is no Ashtoreth or Apollo or, you know, any of these pagan deities for real. So is God giving us a pointless statement? Is he saying, you shall worship, why does he say, you shall worship no other gods before me if there really aren't any other gods? Well, God's talking, that shows you that there's an abstraction here. He's giving something that doesn't exist. He's saying, you won't worship these things that actually don't exist. But he refers to them as gods, even though they don't exist. So are they truly gods? Gods is a word that means mighty ones in the original language. That applies to Elohim as the word, by the way. It also applies to the true God. He says, you shall not worship, you have no other Elohim before me, is what he's really saying here. No mighty ones before me. And so in that sense, we think about it as, is God really referring to these things as gods? Well, that's what people think of them as. And so in that sense, he's pointing out what people treat as gods should not be worshipped. It's broader than this sense of a pagan deity. By the way, I should mention that pagan deities, while they are not really real in one sense, there were an actual reality behind many of them. There were demons that would pose as false gods. And in fact, I'll just refer you to 1 Corinthians 10:20, where Paul says, I don't want you to, you know, to sacrifice to demons. The things that the Gentiles sacrifice to, the gods, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. So their gods, I put that in quote, were not really gods, they were demons. There were actually demons behind their religions. Paul didn't come up with that, by the way. That's mentioned in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and in the Psalms. It mentions how the Israelites had sacrificed to demons when they were practicing these false religions. That's what they were the ones behind the false religion. In any case, what I'm really trying to point out here is that these things were objects of their worship, even though they were not actual gods. But they treated them as gods because they looked to them for salvation and deliverance and help in time of need. And whatever has that conception needs to go. It can't be any part of what we are worshiping. You see, the veneration of nature, some people venerate nature. We think about tree huggers. We call people that are, you know, very overly environmentally protective. We have a responsibility to protect the environment. God gave us that responsibility to tend this garden. But at the same time, people go far overboard in that, and they turn to worshiping the creation, and they go, you know, they think they need to exalt it. Some people see the earth as a goddess. Pantheism, this idea that God is in everything. He's in the rocks and in the plants, and certainly God made everything, and God does fill up all creation, but everything is not God, as people in the Hindu religion and a lot of, which has crept in heavily into America, and this whole New Age concept is everywhere. That is forbidden. All of that is forbidden, of course, by the First Commandment. Astrology is forbidden by the First Commandment. The idea that you can plan out your life based on the movement of the heavenly bodies, that you can open up a paper and read your horoscope and that'll give you some kind of a direction for your life in the way that God describes it. He says in Jeremiah 10, verse 2, be not dismayed at the signs of the heavens, for the heathen are dismayed at them. I can't go out today because it says that Gemini is going to have a bad day. I mean, that's absurd. But some people really direct their lives according to these things. And you have to remember, again, that demons are behind the scenes too, and they could be orchestrating things to make it look like there's some validity to these things. But God says not to put stock in these things. Evolution is a religion. People believe, based against the evidence, that life just happened here, and we just all evolved. And the evidence is very clearly against that. But people don't care about that. They want to prove what they want to believe. And so they go with that. So evolution, the belief in that, is itself a religious system. And it becomes a god that directs their lives. All pagan practices, of course, fall into this broad category. This broad category. If we say, well, what about, like, we observe these pagan holidays, Christmas and so forth. That's not worshiping other gods. Well, let's remember, when we bring in pagan customs into the worship of the true God, that is called syncretism, blending the true religion with false religion. And when we bring these pagan practices into the worship of the true God, he does not look at it as the worship of him. He looks at it as the worship of something false, of the worship of a false god. And we see a very an example of that. I won't have you turn to it, but it's in the example of the golden calf. They're in the book of Exodus where they had Aaron make this golden calf, and he says, here is your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And they proclaimed a feast to the Eternal. It says a feast to Yahweh to celebrate before this golden calf. But God didn't look at it as a feast to him, because he told the people, or he told Moses, they have made a golden calf and they have made sacrifices to it, this other god. He did not say they've made sacrifices to me. He did not look at it as sacrifice to him. That's what they looked at it as, but that's not how he looked at it. So anytime we bring in these pagan practices that were meant for the worship of other gods, that itself is a form of worshiping other gods. The spirit of the first commandment is really expressed in the idea that we are not to place anything before God in our affections or loyalties. We're not to place anything before God in our affections or loyalties. Look over at Mark chapter 12. And by the way, put a marker in Exodus 20. We'll be coming back to this a great deal. And there's another passage we'll go to a little bit, and I'll have you put a marker there as well. But this is one. Keep the marker there because we'll repeatedly come back to it. But Mark 12, we are told, this is basically the two summary commandments, the two great commandments. Verse 28, one of the scribes came, having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he answered well, asked Jesus, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Or, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. That could also be translated. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. This is the first commandment. Well, it's interesting, that wording, this is the first commandment. This is the first commandment of the two great commandments. This is the most important commandment. But this is also the very spirit of the first of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. That's what this commandment is really telling us. This commandment that he's expressing here is the spirit of the first commandment. It is truly the greatest commandment, because if we were to obey it fully, we would also obey every other commandment just because God wants us to. Think about that. If we did this, if we obeyed this commandment, we would be completely obedient to all the commandments automatically. Any transgression of any commandment is also a violation of this first commandment. And I would say any time that we sin in any way, we are putting another God before the true God in our affections and in our loyalties. That is what we have to remember. What is the broad spirit of the commandment? Let's think about things that vie for our affections. Money, that's a huge one. People call it the almighty dollar. Jesus referred to mammon. He said, you cannot serve God and mammon. That's a personification of money in that sense. Mammon is something that people serve because it captures their loyalties and affections. It's important to them, too important. Money is important, of course, but it has to have its place. It has to be subjected to our responsibilities to God. Addictions of the flesh, drug addiction. People get addicted to drugs or smoking or things like that. Gluttony, other fleshly lusts, things that are compelling them. That is idolatry. That is putting another God before the true God, because what happens is it actually takes hold of you and leads you into a direction that you don't want to go. All of these things are embraced by the spirit of the first commandment. This philosophy of hedonism. I'm so bored. I want to have fun all the time. I've got to go out and have fun, fun, fun. That's what life's all about. I just need to pursue a good time. The idea that you have to do that all the time and you have to go out and have a good time, that itself is idolatry. Again, it is a craving that controls your actions beyond what you should be doing. You know, I don't have time to study the Bible because I want to have fun. See how that happened? You put something else as a god in front of the true God. That became a god, and we must not do that. Institutions can become a god. Say a person. Think about Nazi Germany and the respect people had for Hitler, or maybe even in our country, some of the respect that people have for the new Messiah here, and there's other things that people want to follow. Government itself. People worship the government. They follow the government because the government is their provider. It gives them security. It gives them all their needs. And so we have to worship at the altar of the government. And in fact, as I was just talking to Mr. Barnett, the government actually dictates moral issues for us. Not only in rulings on abortion and all these other kinds of things, which certainly they do, but in let's say, approving of a divorce and remarriage. And maybe we accept that when the Bible doesn't accept it. Not to say that there's not grounds for divorce and remarriage in the Bible, but you see what I'm saying. Maybe there's one that there is no grounds for. But the state has sanctioned it, and so we just accept it because the government makes the rules, and we treat them as a god above the true God. Even the church can become an idol. You remember the Israelites when they were all praising this was the Jewish people. They were in trouble. They were being warned. Bad things are going to happen. And Jeremiah mentioned, and they said, well, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. They had the temple of God. They had the place of worship. They didn't think anything could happen to them. God says, remember what happened at Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle used to be before it came and the place was devastated because God allowed that to make a point. People worship the church. I mean, they let the whole organization of the church dictate to them everything about their lives, even beyond what God tells them to do. And they rely on that. Well, it's not my fault. I'm following the church. God doesn't look at it that way. The church, in that sense, has become your God. And you can't have that. You have to have a relationship with God. We have to respect the church, and it's a proper place. Again, these are very important. Celebrities, obviously, celebrities. People, I'd say not just in the sense of people think, well, I don't worship celebrities, but people become so focused on that. You know, it becomes such a big part of life that by spending all this inordinate amount of time keeping up with these things, I think about my wife's cousin. She works on TMZ, the show TMZ. And I mean, if you watch that show ever, it's horrible. But I mean, it just is buried in the lives of these celebrities. And we've got to follow what these people are all doing. And so many people are caught up with that. You go to the supermarkets, all these magazines, I mean, they're there. And everybody wants to know what's going on with this person, what's going on with this person. It consumes so much of people's times that it becomes a god. It just becomes a god because it crowds out what they really ought to be doing and thinking about in terms of God and the truth. Even your family. Look over at Luke 14. Luke chapter 14. By the way, I'm not going to probably get through all the Ten Commandments today. That's okay. I'll have my own series, just like Dr. Hoselton. And that's fine. I mean, this is an important subject, so I don't mind spending a little bit of time thinking about it. Luke chapter 14 and verse 26. I mean, this is an astounding statement. We're actually starting in verse 25. Now, great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, and he must have kind of blown them away because people don't normally think in terms like this. He said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And we think, wow, what is he requiring here? Well, we can parallel this with another passage where he mentioned, it's in the other passage, it says, if he doesn't, if he loves them more than him. And that's really what he's talking about, hatred. In this language, hatred has to do with rejection. You know, like where God said, Jacob I have chosen, Esau I have hated. It's not because God literally hates Esau in the sense of what we think of hatred is, wish I want you dead. What it means is it's a choice. In other words, he accepts one, he rejects the other. This has to do with when it comes to an issue where there is a conflict between Jesus Christ and your family, you have to make a choice. You accept the one, you reject the other. That's the issue of love and hatred that we're talking about here. Some people say it really has to do with, it's by comparison. We love the one so much that by comparison we hate the other. And that's probably true to an extent, but I think it's better to understand this in terms of we accept the one and reject the other whenever there is a conflict. And in this case, if we do not reject our family, if we do not say no to them and put them aside and say no, and it may mean rejecting them altogether. You may have to leave them if there's no, you know, if they won't let you follow God. So God comes first, Jesus Christ comes first, and even your family can become an idol. If you, you know, people might think, oh, you know, I have to put up this Christmas tree in my house because, I'll say this in a household where it's understood that maybe a husband has authority. If a wife is in the house, she doesn't obviously have the authority, but she may say, well, I need to put up the Christmas tree to keep peace in the house with the family. No, she better not put up the Christmas tree. Let me put it that way. If he wants a Christmas tree, he could put it up, and he shouldn't. Now, if the husband is the one that's in the church, it becomes a more difficult issue because, again, there's government intrusion, what people are free to do and not allowed to do. But I would say if he's able to control that situation, he should not allow that. This is where we come into it. I mean, there's many issues where your family can become the ruling God of your life if you allow it to dictate your decisions when it comes to the church. Now, certain things we have to work with, but we need to keep that perspective. Are we allowing the family to take the place of what God's commandments tell us to do in any instance? But notice it says, and even your own life. So it's not even just our families, but it says if he doesn't hate even his own life. So a lot of times we ignore that because it's my way. I want to do it my way. It's not what God says. Well, that's unacceptable to God. We have to get rid of that kind of mentality to follow the first commandment. And then science and technology. That's another part of this category. Science and technology, that will save us. You know, we just need more advanced things. We need better computers. We need better, whatever it might be, inventions to carry us through. You know, you see this in something like Star Trek. I think about a show like Star Trek, where it seems like because they became so scientifically advanced and they got such, you know, made such technological advances, that eventually they were able to just get by their wars and have a peaceful situation. Although it seems like there's always something still happening and there's people, other people coming in and trying to take over or fight or things like that. So they really don't actually take care of all these issues. But science and technology won't bring about a dream world like that. In fact, science and technology is going to bring death to all unless Jesus Christ intervenes and saves the world from ourselves. That's where science and technology will ultimately lead if not subjected to its proper place under obedience to God's commandment and putting God first. God comes first, then we can have a place for these other elements, science and technology. And the idea that, well, and the health industry, the healthcare industry is part of science, you know, they'll save us. They'll create these drugs, they'll give us the security, they'll allow us to extend our lives, they will spare us from these various diseases. Look, I'm not saying they haven't done anything like that. Of course they have. But, again, where do we look to our ultimate salvation and rescue? If we are being told by physicians that we need to do something that God says not to do, I don't know where that might happen, but it could, we don't do that. You know, here you need to take this medicine that's got ground up shark in it. No, we don't need to take that. We're not going to do that. That's not where we put our faith in. Various human philosophies. You know, a lot of people have a value system that is just based on the conceptions of this world. There's a lot of views out there. Certainly, we know some of them. The isms, Marxism, and is one that very prevalently comes to mind. Socialism, these various philosophies, but even things like Epicureanism, Stoicism, this idea that we have to maintain either we want the party spirit or we want to be very emotionless and be ruled by pure logic. If we, you know, that we stress and try to do this, we live an ascetic life. All of these things are anti-God. They are against what the Bible commands. You know, the Bible actually commands us to rejoice. So the idea that we never rejoice is a sin. But yet these are the philosophies of men where we go with some of these things. Our own intellect. We worship our own intellect, our own thinking, how we have reasoned something, and we worship the way we've come to think. When we should really be thinking, well, I'm just thankful I've barely figured this out, but I don't know for sure that I have. I need to make sure that I keep coming to God to be reaffirmed in what I believe. Ourselves, we worship ourselves. We worship what we believe. We worship what we think. And I don't mean to say that we are to prove things to ourselves and learn things. But we have to realize that we have to question why we think what we do. Even a lot of the things we believe that we've been taught from childhood, maybe in the church or whatever it is, we need to always be questioning why do we believe this? And is it true? Is it right? And we need to keep going back to God to reaffirm it. And I'm saying we should reaffirm it. Not that our whole life should be that we're uncertain about everything. But again, it has to do with our reasoning. We don't want to reason independently of God, absolutely. That's very important. The Bible says in Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. Think about that verse. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. You might think, yeah, but I understand this scripture pretty good. Okay, why do you understand it? And how is it, you know, formed in your mind? And do you really know that you've been led to that by your study of this other scriptures and putting the whole Word of God together and you embrace that? Or are you just thinking, well, I think I know what that means, and go with that? That's a mistake, brethren. That's actually idolatry, because we have put our own intellect before relying on God to know it. It's kind of obscure in that sense, because we think, well, yeah, but how do we really know anything? I know what you mean. That's true. You can get befuddled with that. And I'm not saying that we should, again, live your life in perpetual questioning mode. But have a reality check every so often. When you're studying the Word of God, make sure that you're not putting your preconceptions in it, but that you're letting it speak to you as it actually speaks. And some of those preconceptions may be things you've been taught that are not valid. Things you've been taught in the church that are not valid. This is important to all of us. We have to be hearing what God says and not trusting our own intellect or in others. To a degree, we have to have some trust in ourselves and in others. But again, we're talking about by degrees, and where is the ultimate trust and focus? God is a jealous God, he tells us. He says, my name is jealous even. He refers to himself as jealous. He says, I am a jealous God. Now, I remember when I first saw that, I thought, does that mean God is petty? It's because you think of two people and one is talking to somebody else and oh, I don't like you talking to them. And it just starts to get odd because that's jealousy. We think of jealousy in these these human terms. And we think, is that God? Is he? And is God so self-fixated to be jealous? We think jealousy is very self-fixated. So God doesn't want us to be dabbling over here because he's too much caring about himself. He doesn't want our focus to be elsewhere. It can seem like that if you don't really understand the concept of jealousy in what he's saying. At one time, I guess I had the idea that, well, I believe this still. God is jealous for our sakes. That's the truth. Now, at one time, I thought it was more in terms of, well, he just wants what's best for us, and he certainly does. And that's what the terminology there meant, that he doesn't want to share us with something else because that something else would hurt us. That's absolutely true. But there's another aspect to this, and it has to do with a relationship, and even like a marriage relationship, if you want to think about it, what God is talking about when he says, I'm a jealous God. What he's really saying is, you are my special treasure, and that's how I look at you. And think about in a marriage relationship, if one of the couples in the marriage relationship says, you know, I'm just going to go and sleep around with 7 or 8 different people here, and the spouse says, yeah, whatever, that's fine. You know, think about that for a second. Now, the one who's going to go do that, they must think that the one who says, yeah, that's fine, doesn't really treasure them, doesn't really care about them, doesn't really value them. It's only when the person says, no, I don't want you to do that. You're for me, and we're in a special relationship. And then we say, oh, well, that he really does care. And that's the idea with God. I mean, God says, I'm a jealous God, and I don't want you doing these other things or dabbling these other ways, because if you do, you know, if he didn't do that, then it would kind of mean that he didn't really care about this special relationship, if he allowed us to just go and do whatever. But he does, and he also cares about our well-being. Both things are part of him being jealous. But the issue is, with the first commandment, brethren, is God first in your life? Is God first in your life? That's what it really comes down to. And probably the answer is, not all the time. And that's because anytime we sin, really, he's not. But in general, we should strive to make sure that he is. And to overcome whatever we are able to do with his help. Commandment number 2, let's go back to Exodus 20. Exodus 20, verse 4, 5, and 6. It's a long commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, in one sense, this is obviously talking about literal images. But I want us to notice a few things first. First of all, it says, you shall not make a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. So does that mean we can't draw or make a statue of a bird, or of, it says that is in the earth, meaning on the earth, or that we can't draw a tree, or that we can't draw anything that's in the water under the earth, so we can't draw fish? I mean, it almost sounds like that, but that's why the next sentence is important. Because, and we know that doesn't strictly mean that. You know, God actually told them to draw certain things and make certain images, and so he was not telling them to violate his commands. But the next part is the key. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. That's the key. And, well, what about angels? Well, it's probably safer not to do that. We don't really fully know what they look like. I mean, we can imagine them. But I mean, the Israelites did create cherubim. I mean, they put them on the ark. They drew them on the curtains of the veil. They built big cherubim up in the temple. But of course, they were shown miraculously how to do that. God helped them to be able to do it. But just the very nature of making an image of an angel is what I want to show you is not idolatry. Because if it were, they would not have been allowed to do that, clearly. The real key, again, is this next part of the statement. Because really, it doesn't only mention angels, it's talking about everything. It's talking about don't make any images of anything in the sky or on the ground or beneath the ground. Don't draw anything. And some people believe that, by the way. Some people think this commandment, you're not allowed to draw anything. A lot of the people, there's past times when people thought that. But really the key is, again, the next part. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, he says. And then he goes forward to say the rest. So the real key is that we are not to draw images or create statues or forms that to bow down to them and serve them. That's the real point here. But anything we would bow down to and serve falls in that same vein. Any kind of a symbol. You know, Israelites were also forbidden to make standing images of any kind, really, like a cross, for instance. But people put up these crosses, they put up statues of figures from the New Testament. Mary, I remember really freaking out when I first went into a Catholic church, and I went, this was when I was in high school, but I was up here visiting in St. Louis, and I went to there's a cathedral in St. Louis, and you walk over, and there's a statue of Mary, and there's a place where down at the bottom where you kneel at it, and you're right in front of the statue, and you're kneeling up looking at this statue of Mary, and right on this cloth underneath her, it said, Maria Caelum Regina, which means in Latin, Mary Queen of Heaven. So I thought, and I was in Latin class at the time, so I knew what that said, and I just thought to myself, this is unbelievable. I mean, this is a clear violation of the commandment. But it's not the only violation of the commandment. There's many others, of course, putting up any kind of the symbols. Images limit God. They limit God because we have to think God is the all-powerful creator of the universe who can't be contained even by the heaven of heavens. But people want to represent him in some way, and the problem is you really can't because he doesn't want that. So do we draw God? I mean, he says, well, it's the main point is we not to draw him to worship him. But when it comes to God, it's a little bit more. I'd say it's best that we don't. Because when we do that, the very nature of drawing God puts us in this idea that we've captured the essence of God. Well, we haven't. God is so far beyond anything. And I will say that in God's worship, he never had any images of himself. He only allowed these images of these cherubim, never of himself. Never. They had the focal point of their worship was the Ark of the Covenant, of course, and the people really weren't even allowed to see it. They weren't allowed to even go near there because God's holiness was so sacrosanct, it would not even permit them to be near that. So, you know, and he told them also elsewhere, he said that he did command them not to make any form. He says, because you saw no form when he came there and spoke the commandments. He did not appear to them in a form. He did not want to be represented that way because that, again, limits God. Puts God in a box or in a picture frame, as it were. Yeah, we've captured him. No, we haven't. What about images of Jesus? Well, this is a little bit murkier. Jesus actually came as a human being. He lived as a human being. Others actually saw him as a human being. So we imagine if one of them later painted him, would that have been a problem? I don't really know the answer to that. But it doesn't sound like a good idea. Because what happens is, again, you sort of believe, well, I've sort of captured him, and there's my focal point of worship. And you know, whenever you draw something, especially now, we really don't know what he looked like, and we were going to capture his look or smile. We don't really know what his look or smile was. And so we're actually attributing something to him that's not certain. But yet we'll watch movies that have Jesus in it, and I'm fine with that to a point. But even that, we all have to be careful that we are very cognizant of the fact that this is not really Jesus and this is all an interpretation. And if you start thinking about it in those terms, this is a problem. I usually don't have a problem with if somebody in some illustrated book has a picture of Jesus doing something, although usually I do because it's the long-haired Jesus, didn't really look anything like him. But if they get it more correct, I'm happier with that. But again, would you take that picture and put it up on your wall? It's not a good idea because, again, you sort of think you've captured this essence of him, and he's far beyond that now. We don't think of Jesus as much in the flesh. We think of him as the divine, almighty creator that we worship. But we do remember that he was in the flesh. He did come, and he did live as a man, and he did teach and help people, and they saw him. And so later in life, the people who saw him, they would certainly remember him. But even in doing so, they really weren't to think of him in those terms anymore. They were to think of him as in divine glory, changed and risen and glorified and powerful and able to intervene for them at any moment. The second commandment in the Spirit also forbids having a limiting image of God in our minds. It forbids having a limited image of God in our minds. Because that's what we're really talking about. Let's think about when we, again, keeping these commandments in the Spirit. You say, well, in the physical sense of that, I don't make any images or representations that are going to limit God, that are going to bring him down to this small image. But we got to make sure we don't do that in our minds, that we don't limit God. We don't have this concept of him that prevents him from doing what I remember back when we were having the changes a long time ago in our former association, and we had a person who would say he was basically saying God cannot exist in space because God created space. And I thought that was absurd because I thought, well, so Bill can't live in his house because he made his house. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, I will say this. I mean, God obviously transcends space. He transcends space and time. He's greater than all that. But he can, of course, live within it. He actually says in the Bible, he stretched out the heavens as the tent to dwell in. The fact is, God can do whatever he wants, and I think that's what we need to remember and keep focused on. God can do whatever he wants. There's only a few things that God is limited from doing by nature of the things that they are. For instance, God cannot create holy, righteous character instantaneously by fiat, because that's against what character is. Character is something that's developed and built and chosen by an entity. It can't be imposed. If it's imposed, it's not really character. Oh, it's not really holy, righteous character in the sense of God wants us to choose righteousness. There's only a few things God can't do. He's limited by the very nature of those things. People say, well, can God create a rock that's so big that he can't move it? Well, I would say the answer to that is really no. You've limited a God. Well, no, it's limited by very nature of what it is. When an irresistible force meets an immovable object, you can't have that situation. There can't be two such things. I mean, that's the problem. So, but whatever it is, there may be other things we think of, well, God can't do. I got this problem with my job at work, and you know, I'm not praying about that. I mean, what can God really do about it? God can do anything. I mean, there's so much that he can do. I mean, it's almost infinite, the things that God can do. So God can do a great, and so let's not limit God in our minds. Anything that we might do that would make us think that God is not able to intervene, that God is not able to do whatever needs to be done, that's limiting God, and that's a violation actually of the second commandment, because it's a false image of God. What about false concepts of God? Any kind of a false conception about God. If you think God is a certain way, you remember I mentioned in Romans, in the book of Romans, Paul talks about the Gentiles, how they devolved into their pagan concepts of God. And it says, and they made the divine image into birds and creeping things and corruptible men. Corruptible men. Now, I want us to think about that because God, we believe, does look like a man in a hyperdimensional sense, I'm sure that we can't really imagine. But human beings were created in the form and shape of God. on a physical level. But, and so is Paul saying that it was wrong when they had this idea that God was made into human form? No. The problem is it says that they made him into corrupt, he was made, the image was made into corruptible men. And you think about these Greek gods and their petty infighting and their bickering and the way that they would act toward one another. If we think of God in those terms, and maybe we think, you know, God is vengeful in one sense, but maybe we think of God as sort of vindictive. He kind of wants to get us because he doesn't like, if he's going to get back at me for that, as if he acts that way, that's a violation of this commandment about having a false image of God. You've manufactured that or taken it from someone else. It is not a true picture of God. It is a false image, a false picture. The Trinity doctrine is an absolutely false doctrine, but it is also a false image, a false conception of God. We've crafted this picture of God. Think about it. It's a false picture. It's a false image. It violates this commandment because it gives us a whole wrong idea and view about what God is and what God's whole purpose is in creating man to raise a family. The Trinity obscures all of that, and it allows in so many other rampant and false ideas and problems. It is a gateway doctrine, I think we talked about here before, to all manner of wrong thinking. Comes from a false image. John 4:24. Turn over there if you will. John 4:24. In John 4, actually, let's back up a little bit because Jesus was having this encounter with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman. And in verse 20, she says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. And you Jews say that," and she was talking about Mount Gerizim there in near Shechem. "And you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father.'" And again, I want us to think about a little bit about what that's saying, because they had a focus on place. They were actually wrong about where their place was. It was Jerusalem was the place. But he was saying that's not really the ultimate focus. It's not about where you go. It's about where you look and who you look to and where your focus is. He says, but then there's an interesting statement. He says, "You worship what you do not know." So the Samaritans had this worship system. A lot of it was biblical, but there was a lot of syncretism involved, taken from ancient Babylonian religion as well. But there was much that was taken from Scripture in what they did. You can go there now and see they do a lot of scriptural things still. They actually do the Passover sacrifices still. I mean, it's quite interesting. But anyway, the way he describes this is, you worship what you do not know. We know what we worship. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. You know, sometimes people have this idea that, well, the nature of God, that's not really a salvation issue. That's not a point of salvation. But I think it's interesting, Jesus' wording here. He says, we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. He clearly ties knowing what we worship to a salvation issue. That is a salvation issue. Because if we are, you know, don't really know who we're worshiping, if we have a wrong concept of God, then we're not really worshiping God. We're worshiping a false image of God, which is effectively a false God. Verse 23, "But the hour is coming and now is." So it already is, even though they had a place for worship. But he was saying it's going to be a manifest later. But it already is the case, he's saying, that when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit. He is beyond this physical realm. And those who worship him must worship in spirit. So we are to come before God in our minds and our thoughts and our focus. We're to come before him. We are to worship in spirit and truth. And that truth goes to knowing whom we worship, to understanding who this God is. to really not having a false concept of God, to having a true concept of God that we've derived from the Bible. We have to worship in truth. And truth also has to do with how we live, and we'll get to that later when we come to later commandments. But it also involves understanding the truth and having the truth as the basis of our worship. Commandment number three. Commandment number three, go back to Exodus 20. And I'm thinking we're going to end today with commandment number three. So if we go back to Exodus 20, we'll read that commandment. And it says, and this is in verse 7, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." So we've just been talking about the image, the conception of God. Now we're talking about the name of God. And of course, a name is more than just what somebody calls you. It also has to do with what you represent, the person. Like when we think of in the name of the law, I come in the name of the law, meaning you're representing the law. So the name of God has to do with it's who he is, but it also is all that he stands for, all that he represents. All of these things are part of the name of God. They're embraced by that, and we are not to take that, any of that, in vain. And in vain means uselessly or to no purpose. Certainly it applies directly to the actual usage of God's name. Profanity. We think of profanity. Now, we usually think of profanity as just people giving expletives that need to be beeped out on regular television or something. And that is profanity. Actually, that's worse than profanity. I take that as, I mean, it's labeled profanity today, but it's really a blasphemy. But profanity, if we understand the word profane, what does it mean to profane something? We think of it as, well, to profane something means to... It's a sacrilege. It's taking something holy and dragging it through the dirt. Well, it is, but it's more plain than that, really. To profane means to treat as common. That's what it means, literally. The idea of profane, to profane something, is to just treat it as not special, not holy. That's why you can do whatever with it that you want. That's what people do with God's name. That's profanity. It's bandied about. Any use of God's name is really profanity, that if it's not being used to a right purpose. One should never even exclaim, "Oh my God," you hear it all the time. You see it abbreviated, OMG, everywhere. It's terrible today, but one should never say that unless it's part of an actual prayer to God. I mean, you can pray to God, you know, "Oh my God, please help me." That's fine. But just to exclaim, "Oh my God," when you're not really thinking about God, and that's the way our society is taught to express itself. And sometimes it's hard for us just because we've grown up with certain things that's what you say. But it shouldn't be what we say, and we need to work hard to make sure we get rid of these things. Society is inundated with all this kind of stuff. The same goes for euphemistic expressions many consider innocent, such as, "Oh my gosh." I mean, that doesn't sound so bad. And we think, well, we've avoided saying God, but we've kind of still got God in there a little bit. And it's really a slur on the name of God to kind of evoke the same expression, but in a polite way that doesn't, maybe God will overlook it because we didn't actually say God. We just said, "Oh my gosh." It's like if I, you know, I stubbed my foot against the wall, and I said, maybe I'm used to saying, "Oh Brian," but I just instead I just said, "Oh Brian," you know, I mean, oh, that was okay because I substituted something else. It's just not a good idea. We need to avoid these kind of things. Or "Jeez," that's a very common one. "Jeez." I think "sheesh" is a takeoff of "geez," but it may be a takeoff of the other word, the SH word. But it's hard to say. I mean, but it's probably a bad one to avoid too. But Jesus is Jesus. I mean, it's short for that. That's where it comes from. A lot of these. I mean, there are a whole list of them. But there's a lot of things like this that are things we just should not say, substituting similar sounding words for God and Jesus. But what about, man, he caught, thank God he caught that. Right? If God is not being truly and consciously thanked, that breaks this commandment. You can't say that. That is unacceptable to say thank God if you're not really thanking God. Because again, what are we doing? We're using it purposelessly. We're using it to no effect, to no good effect. We're just throwing God's name in there because it's something to say. That's what you say. And God doesn't want to be just what you say. We only use God's name for a reason, if it's communicating something of value. We must not swear. Turn to Matthew 5. And I was going to have you hold your place here in Matthew 5, but we're not going to be coming back to it today. It'll be on the, when we get to the next set of the commandments. But Matthew 5, Jesus is very explicit here in verses 33 to 37. He says, again, you've heard it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely. And again, that ties in a little bit to the ninth commandment. We'll get to that later. He says, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it's its footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king, which is interesting because in these cases, you're not swearing by God directly, but by something that represents God. So you don't swear by the Bible either. You think about that in courts, people put their hands on the Bible and they swear by the Bible. Nor shall you swear by your head. Because you cannot make one hair white or black. I mean, you didn't make your head. The one who did is God. Again, God is the object of swearing. But let your yes be yes and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. We're not to swear. That doesn't mean that we're not to make promises. We can make promises with the caveat that we can't uphold them. Or, you know, the idea of swearing is that you are invoking God to act. And that's the, by the way, here's a definition of swear. This is the definition of the word swear from the American Heritage Dictionary. To make a solemn declaration invoking a deity or sacred person or thing in confirmation of and witness to the honesty or truth of such a declaration. So we shouldn't even be saying, well, I swear that's true. We just should not swear, Jesus said, because we are invoking God in something where, you know, we don't have ultimate control over all of reality. Maybe we've misperceived things, or maybe we're not going to be able to fulfill what we've said, because we're not in ultimate control. And that's what we need, why we should not be swearing, because we don't want to invoke God in some punishment that he might bring if we don't fulfill the terms of what we've said. Conduct, that's another area that we are not to take God's name in vain. Romans 2, if you'll look over there real quickly, Romans 2. In Romans 2, and we are at almost 11:30, so I'll finish up here in just a couple minutes. Romans 2, the Apostle Paul explains that people who hypocritically call themselves by God's name and portray themselves as his people while refusing to obey him actually blaspheme his name. Now here's what he said to some of his countrymen. Look at verses 21 through 24. He says, you therefore, he's talking to Jews, he says, you therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For, quote, and he's quoting from the Old Testament here, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And he's quoting from Ezekiel 36, where God, and a few times, talks about how Israel profaned, it says there, Israel profaned my name among the nations, God says. And so God's saying to the Jews, that's what you're doing. You're blaspheming God's name among the Gentiles. Not by what you're saying per se, but by the fact that you're acting not in accordance with what you represent and stand for. You are acting differently, and therefore you are bringing reproach on the name of God. You are bringing shame on the name of God. That itself is a blasphemy against God, the very act that brings that reproach. 1 Timothy 6, we see the same thing if you flip over there. 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1, Paul actually says something interesting. He's talking to people that are slaves, basically. And he did not want to bring a wrong reproach on the church. So he says, let as many bondservants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor. So they were supposed to do what was required of where they were in life, so that, he says, the name of God and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. So again, if they went against that, if they just turned into rebels, everybody would think of the church as this rebellious force in the empire, and it would have been not what God intended. It would have brought, it wasn't what God was trying to bring about through the church, and it would have brought shame and blasphemy. So that itself was a blasphemy. In the end, it is not enough to just avoid misusing God's name. He wants us to love and respect him. Honoring him begins where? It begins in our thoughts. And again, when we think about these commandments in the spirit, not just in the letter, in the thoughts, we must know who and what he is. We must know what he requires of us and why. We need to understand all these things. We should admire his wisdom, his love, fairness, and justice. We need to stand in awe of his power and recognize that our existence depends on his goodness. Then we should talk to him in prayer every day. We should follow the admonition in Psalms to give him thanks and to praise him. These are the positive sides. We're not to take God's name in vain, but we are to take God's name to good effect, to good purpose. Let's think about that. That's what we're talking about now. We should acknowledge his greatness. We should ask him to create in us his way of thinking and character. We should request the power of his spirit to enable us to wholeheartedly obey and serve him. This is all what's really embraced by this, the spirit of this commandment. Because if we know what we're not supposed to do with God's name, then we can see by that what we should be doing. If we're not to take it in vain, then we are to take it to a good purpose. That's implied. Let's put it that way. It's not directly stated, but it's implied. Because we're clearly to take God's name, and if we don't take it in vain, we have to take it to good. And so these are the good that we are to take it to. We honor God most of all by loving him so much that we desire all above all things to be like him and to accurately represent him to everyone who sees or knows us. That's how we really talk well about God, is how we live. Yes, we want to praise him in our words, but also in our deeds. You know, Matthew 15 and Mark 7, Jesus talked about the Pharisees. He said, "In vain they worship me, teaching for commandments the doctrines of men." But they ignored God's commandments. And that was the problem. They were coming up with their own rules. And that was the doctrines. And that itself is vain worship. Christ said that's vain worship. So they were, again, using God's name, his commandments, his doctrines, but they were using them in vain because they were not following what he said to actually do. And finally, turn over to 2 Timothy 2. And we'll end with this verse today. 2 Timothy 2. You know, that incident there in that I was just talking about where Christ said that to the Pharisees, The issue there had to do with how they were treating their parents. They weren't helping their parents because they were giving money to the temple. And so that was violating another of the actual commandments, which we'll get to that one here in the next message that I give when I get to that. But that's the concept. I mean, they were putting their own ideas and ways in front of what God had actually directed. But look, when we call on God, it must be to a good effect. That's what we really are talking about in this commandment. And we see it in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19. It says, "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God," here it is at the root, "the foundation of God stands, having this seal: the Lord knows those who are His." So that's one, it's God first. He brings us into that relationship. And here's our responsibility: let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity, depart from lawlessness. Everyone who names the name. If you name the name, then you are to depart from iniquity, because otherwise you are blaspheming the name. We are not to take the name in vain. We are to take it to full purpose, to good effect. That is embraced all by the spirit of the third commandment. As you can see, brethren, as we're starting to go through these, each of these commandments is exceedingly broad, as David said. It involves much more than the strict letter wording that's there, but the strict letter wording implies all that we've been talking about. And we have other direct... They never existed in isolation, by the way. The Ten Commandments were given to a society that had other laws that God gave. That's just the basics on which the others rest. And we need to keep that in perspective as we go through this and do our best to strive to uphold God's commandments and live by them, not just in what we might claim to be a minimal standard of righteousness, but understanding that they are broad categories that govern the whole of our lives.